All right, well, welcome to this seminar as part of the Global Labor Speaker Series. I'm just going to start off by mentioning our co-sponsors, because I forgot to the last talk. So we're co-sponsored by the Department of Social Science, Department of Politics, Department of History, School of Social Work, CERLAC, Faculty of Education, Department of Geography, Department of Sociology, and School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies.
So two of us are here from there.
Thank you for your support. We appreciate that. And I also want to mention our next event before I get to this one. On November 8th, a panel on not caring, privatization, hybridization, and resistance in contemporary care work. And that's actually with Donna Baines down here.
We see you on the big screen.
And Pat Armstrong and Tamar Daly. So that's coming up on November 8th at 12 o'clock in Ross North 836A. All right, today we have two very special people. They're so special to me because we did our PhDs together at Cornell in the same year, part of the same cohort, and stayed friends over that time. And they've been doing some really interesting work individually and also collectively. So I'll start with Tammy, who's on the big screen there. Tammy Lee is a industrial engineer and labor lawyer by professional training, and then went on to get her PhD from the Department of Labor Relations, Law, and History from the ILR School at Cornell. Her academic research focuses on the popular participation of workers in macro-level political and economic reform in Cuba and the United States. She also conducts research on the political practice of workers under the National Labor Relations Act, the intersection of labor and racial justice, cross-movement solidarity building, and the impact of radical adult education on workplace democracy. Her teaching focuses on identity politics in the workplace and labor market discrimination. And Tammy is at Rutgers University, an assistant professor in labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University. And then we have Maite Tapia, who's joining us in person today. She's an assistant professor at the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. And her research revolves around organizing strategies of trade unions and community organizations in the US and Europe, as well as work, migration, and the concept of intersectionality. She's published in British Journal of Industrial Relations, Socioeconomic Review, International Journal of HRM, Journal of Industrial Relations, and co-editor of the 2014 Cornell University Press book, Mobilizing Against Inequality, Unions, Immigrant Workers, and the Crisis of Capitalism. So, two very interesting and awesome women here today to talk to us about the women's march and intersectional organizing. How it's going to go is unfortunately we didn't figure out the tech totally properly to have Tammy up there at the same time and the PowerPoint and all that. So we're going to just show the PowerPoint for now. Tammy can see Maite and the PowerPoint, and then at the end we're going to flip it around when there's questions and answers. All right. So without further ado, take it away, Maite.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tammy. Kelly. And Tammy for being there. Yeah. Thank you so much for this kind introduction and for inviting us here, me in person, Tammy virtually, at the Global Labor Research Center here at York. Seems like you had really great presentations and people coming in the past. Seems like a great center, so thanks for the invitation. So this is a paper that Tammy and I have been working on. It's on the Women's March and Intersectional Organizing and Building Unity by Radically Confronting Our Differences. This has, Tammy has started this work and has very close access, as we'll see further in the paper, to the leadership. So she's very much has been the driver of this paper, and I've been very happy to be on board of it as well. And unfortunately, she couldn't be here in person because she's teaching today and tomorrow, but she's definitely, so she's on Skype, as we know, and she can also answer any questions or will chime in whenever she wants to. So to start off, to give a bit of the importance in terms of the context, so Tammy and I are both, among other things, industrial relations scholars. And so we do view unions as kind of the traditional mechanism for the working class fight against inequality. But at the same time, we also know that, especially in the US, unions have been on the decline. while unions are on the decline, at the same time, there's also this period now in the US of heightened public protest and discourse grounded in identity politics. And over the past few years, especially, we've seen a large number of marginalized workers that have taken, the streets and mobilized in very high-profile, expansive campaigns for social justice on the basis of race, gender, migration status, and other non-class identities. So in this context, what we see is essentially these supra-union campaigns that come up in an era of union decline and political unrest. So what we argue in the paper is that historically, when you look at trade unions, often they have taken on a melting pot approach. And by that, we mean that their main focus has been on class identity, more of taking on an economistic position, so presupposing a collective identity based on class, while at the same time downplaying or disregarding other dimensions such as race, gender, immigrant status. So thinking about we will organize workers as workers and kind of downplay the fact that they could be migrant workers or women, and so therefore there would be different needs, different interests. So as a result, for many workers, especially in the US, they've been essentially waiting for a trickle-down social justice. And so there's this need for more encompassing representation and a way to voice amplified oppression. So for example, while unionization, we know that unionization reduces the wage gap, at the same time, unionized Latina workers continue to suffer a 29 cent wage gap per dollar compared to unionized white non-Hispanic men. So there's still that intra-class inequity essentially that is often not addressed. And we often just say, well, they're unionized, therefore it's all better, without actually addressing the differences within the classes of union members. So building now on our prior research, we looked at these other types of campaigns that are not strictly run by unions, but we call them supra-union campaigns. And so we looked at the Fight for 15 movement and also a worker center called ROC, Restaurant Opportunity Center, and show how in both of these cases, these organizations put a lot of emphasis on the intersectionality of worker identities when they frame the worker and campaign interests. And so while they do things similar as traditional unions, so they try to organize workers that are unorganized, they try to build alliances, at the same time, the difference is that indeed for these organizations, they really acknowledge the amplified discrimination against workers falling at the intersections of multiple identities. So the Restaurant Opportunity Center, or ROC, would acknowledge that these are not just workers, they're immigrant workers, and they're immigrant workers of color. So, and therefore that it was constantly an emphasis on these intersecting identities as a way to actually then organize the workers, unite workers across their differences, essentially. Again, rather than saying a melting pot, we're all just workers, very much emphasizing the differences. And Tammy, feel free to interrupt whenever, okay? Okay. So this in this paper, what we're doing, we're taking the Women's March as a critical case study. And the Women's March has a long, I'll go over it in a second, but it's been now in the second year or something, or the third year. But it has gone from a campaign to a movement to now trying to think about itself as an organization. And it is a critical case of essentially trying to strategically organize in a very divided and a very diverse society. And in addition, if we just look at the Women's March for the US, that was when the first march happened in January. That was the largest single day of protest in US history. And so it's an attempt to try to understand intersectional organizing, and at the same time trying to understand what does this mean for this labor movement that is in decline, what can we learn from it. So in terms of the research questions, the main question is, what is intersectional organizing? So a lot has been written about intersectionality, for example, in women's studies, in sociology, critical race studies, but not that much focuses on the organizing aspect, essentially, and the kind of the deeper processes of what does it really mean, how do you do it? So through the data that Tammy gathered, we tried to think of how do we define it, what is its purpose, what are the major components, and in what ways is it important to the study and practice of labor relations and labor organizing. And let me know if you have any comments or questions. Feel free to interrupt, of course. So in terms of the literature review, we kind of draw on two broad streams. So one is critical race theory and intersectionality, and the other one is strategic worker organizing, so more of the classic industrial relations theory. So in terms of critical race theory, it's a theory that examines essentially the existing power structures and that emphasizes the pervasiveness of institutional racism within society. So it was no surprise that this theory was mainly that is emerged from legal scholars and especially people of color that argued that the laws are not a simple tool for justice, but often actually are support systems for inequalities. And so the main assumptions or the main tenets of this theory are the following that we listed there. So first, they argue that racism is normal in US society. And so that means that it's the usual way that society does business. It's a common everyday experience of most people of color in this country. Second, the importance of when you study any type of phenomena to historically contextualize it and to think about whiteness as property. In essence, that means understanding that there's this white racial domination or supremacy, and it will restructure itself to protect its privileges. The third is that racial justice will only occur when the interests of dominant groups converge with those of the vulnerable groups. So this is about interest convergence. Next is the importance of storytelling and offering these counter narratives, because often in our research, for example, we tell our stories or we tell the research from a very ethnocentric or hegemonic way. And so we erase the counter narratives often from people of color within our story and then present our story as the main way as how we should understand the phenomena. And lastly, it's also about critiquing the idea of a meritocracy, of color blindness, critiquing the idea that a society is fair and equal and that individuals will just succeed by their own merits. So essentially, it's a really it's thinking about racism in a very systemic, institutional way that is ever present. And so, how do we then take this into account when we do any type of research, essentially? And we'll get to that more later in the paper. So that's critical race theory. Then expanding from critical race theory, you have intersectionality, and I know some of you have done also work in that area. And intersectionality, as many of you know, is a term that was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, but was used already by movements before that, of course, and talks about this amplified oppression that people face when falling into several marginalized identities simultaneously. So essentially what Kimberly Crenshaw, a critical race scholar, was showing is that when black women went to court and argued that GM was General Motors was discriminating against them because General Motors was not hiring black women in the 60s, the court said, well, there's no race discrimination because we hired black men, and there's no gender discrimination because we hired white women. So Kimberly Crenshaw was showing, because of that intersection of being black and a woman, they had amplified oppression, and that we can't think about gender and race discrimination in these traditional, within traditional boundaries, or in a traditional sense. And so now, yes, and Tammy wants to, will add something, yes.
But wait, let me put the volume higher.
Small point, I just wanted to tell the audience that the reason that photo is up there is that that is Kimberly Crenshaw with the blue glasses.
Cool. And the other person is Tammy Lee, of course. And that was taken at one of the campaigns by the Women's March, Power to the Polls in Las Vegas, right, Tammy?
Yes.
Cool. Okay. And so in this paper, we look at, we take critical race and intersectionality as one of the main theories through which we understand the Women's March. And so it's really about centering the role of race. It's dedicated to race-conscious social justice, and it's challenging, essentially, that melting pot approach that not only has been done by unions in practice, but also a lot by industrial relations scholars in their research. And so it's thinking about how to not just use race as a descriptor, but doing a deeper socio-cultural or socio-structural analysis of the phenomenon. And let me, Kelly, can you? Okay, go ahead, Tammy.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to the lit review is that CRTI, while originally based in that social construct of race, especially as we added intersectionality to the way we think about social constructs, we're also thinking outside of race as well. So we're looking at the intersections of other social constructs like gender, for instance, and seeing and doing more research that's looking at those things. So even though it's critical race theory and intersectionality, we should expand our understanding that, you know, we also approach theory from a very able-bodied sense. So we need to make sure that we are thinking about the construct of ability, right, or gender. So just a small note.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. So that's kind of the first theory that we use to apply, that we use in this case. Then the second one is, so thinking more about industrial relations scholars, industrial relations theory, so the strategic worker organizing. So the first point to note is that within industrial relations, the scholarship, actually, even though Crenshaw is, you could think of the work of Crenshaw, thinking about labor law, employment law, talking about black women workers in the labor market, seems to be very pertinent to what we study within, you know, our research on work and employment relations. When we look at the U.S., the key journals, the highest quality journals in the U.S. on industrial relations, none of the authors have ever mentioned Crenshaw, intersectionality, critical race, which to a certain extent is actually surprising and appalling almost, as you know, shocking, I guess. And that doesn't mean that they don't use race in their work, but they use it much more as a descriptor rather than, again, thinking about it in a deeper sense of a socio-structural analysis, essentially, and in a more systemic way of how race actually influences or has an influence on whatever phenomena. Race, gender, and so on, as Tammy said, on whatever phenomena you study. So that's the first point. And then again, when we're thinking about strategic work or organizing, a lot of the research has been done from kind of this melting pot approach. So thinking about traditional organizing, how do you do this? You get this collective sense of identity, a collective sense of injustice, but often that is in terms of economistic class terms and doesn't really focus on the different identities. And so we know from previous research, if there is union revitalization's attempt without actually an intersectional analysis, then you tend to
the degenerate group unity and this type of compulsory uniformity, and again it will benefit some members at the expense of others, and you will recreate again that intra-class inequality or inequity. And others have also shown, looking at different organizing campaigns, especially in the UK, some in Canada, not many in the US, but have shown that by treating all workers in a homogeneous way, unions also miss and fail at mobilizing them because they focus so much on wages and benefits and not on issues that are really pertinent to their social identity, the discrimination that they face as women workers, the disrespect, and so on. So not taking into account these non-class identities has repercussions for the labor movement itself, and as well as of how we analyze and understand the organizing then as researchers. So then in terms of the methodology, so we took on a grounded theory approach, so meaning that we did the data gathering and analysis or interpretation simultaneously, and we tried to, from the data, kind of build theory. And we worked in a research team, so our team was composed of consisted of black and white women, native born, US naturalized, queer identified, heterosexuals. And that was important because it did allow us to also explore and engage with our subjects and the data in kind of an identity centered and intersectional way. So also in our methodology and our analysis, it was important to have kind of that intersectional component. Then in terms of participant observation, Tammy, I don't know if you prefer to go over it since you've been part of all these, since you were key in these. Let me just...
Hear me?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. So the way the participant observation was done is this sort of ended up being a natural experiment with Women's March. I was originally researching an organization called the Gathering for Justice, which is in the United States. There's a famous activist actor who used to do civil rights with Dr. King named Harry Belafonte. Gathering for Justice is Harry Belafonte's racial and labor justice organization. They focus on criminal justice reform and labor reform. And so while I was embedded in that organization, its executive director, who is Carmen Perez, received a phone call from the people, from some white women who had started a Facebook group called Women's March, who were planning a march on Washington, to have Carmen come on board and a few other women who we'll talk about to diversify the leadership of the Women's March, and we'll talk about why that was important. So the key thing from a methodological standpoint is that this was a natural experiment that sort of dropped into our hands, and so we're really glad that we were there from the very beginning. And so since 2016, and so obviously Women's March starts towards, after the election of Trump in November 2016, we followed them so far through five campaigns. Women's March is now a 501(c) organization who is still very active, most recently in the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court justice opposition that you saw in the United States. So, but we stopped this 2 years of Women's March, so we have five major campaigns. We'll take you through those. And so we think it's important to study Women's March from campaign to movement, right? So, yeah, they organized a protest, a campaign, but how do we look at organizing from one simple campaign to whether or not it is an actual movement, and what that looks like for strategic organizing? And so some other things that we did methodologically is that we also sort of shadowed Carmen Perez because it's her definition of intersectionality that was embraced by Women's March. And we can talk about the differences between how Women's March organizers define intersectionality and how we look at it and define it as theorists. But Carmen was the heart of intersectionality for Women's March. So we shadowed her for those 2 years.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm trying to keep up with your slides, though. And so, yeah, so semi-structured interviews was the key. Other than participant observation, we had sit-down interviews with all four of the co-chairs of the March on Washington, and also national leaders who were responsible for the framing of Women's March's intersectional framework. And then we also sat through very importantly to one of the key components that we're going to talk about of intersectional organizing, we sat through training with the Women's March team and the Gathering for Justice team to learn about Kingian nonviolence as their approach to organizing. And we'll tie that in as we continue the story.
Thanks, Tammy. So as Tammy mentioned, there's been important in terms of the background of the Women's March. So it got started after the election of Trump, and the first biggest one was essentially the Women's March on Washington in January. Then you had the march from the National Rifle Association to the Department of Justice. Let me just say that again, Tammy, because you were on quiet.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I just want to explain, make sure the audience understands that we were looking at the Women's March at the national level.
Yeah.
So this is a very, Women's March is now super decentralized. You can find local chapters of Women's March. They're not necessarily tied to the strategic organizing of the national, but I can explain that relationship if people have questions later. But it's very important for what we're saying here that this was at the national level.
Yeah, that's a good point. So these are the marches, and to just give a little bit of background on them. So as I said, the Women's March on Washington was seen as the single largest day of protest in the U.S. ever. Then you had the Women's Convention in Detroit, where they had workshops and about 4,000 attendees. So Tammy was also there, and one of my graduate students was there. You had the Power to the Polls in Las Vegas. Tammy was also there, and that was the picture with Kimberly Crenshaw that you saw earlier. Then they had the march from the National Rifle Association to the Department of Justice, which Tammy also participated in. So as you see, that's been very critical to this paper, of course, that Tammy has been really present from the beginning, really inserted in the organization, has had access behind closed doors, you know, as well in part of the organization, so behind doors, as well as part of the movement, the campaign, as well as in these one-on-one conversations. That has really been the key to getting to this paper. And then lastly, most recently, they had also the national school walkout that was after the shooting that happened at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. So these are some of the main marches, essentially, that the Women's March has organized over the past 2 years. In terms of the national co-chairs, so you have Bob Blanche, who's a white woman, lives in New York City, a fashion designer, and as I'll say later, she kind of started this with a Facebook group. Then very important key leaders, women of color from key leaders within their communities came in. So you have Carmen Perez, the executive director of the Gathering for Justice, Linda Sarsour, an executive director also with the Gathering for Justice board member, and Tamika Mallory. And you see three of them depicted on the right and the Essence. So on the upper left is Tamika, and then the second line, the second person from the right is Linda Sarsour, and then the bottom, the one most on the right is Carmen Perez, and then here you have Bob Bland and Cassidy Finley, who's the communications director. And again, Tammy Lee is very close to all of them and has had different conversations with them. So that's kind of a lot in terms of the background, literature review, the context. So let's now get into our analysis, essentially, of what we want to talk about today. So let's start first with intersectional organizing and what it is. And so based on all the data that was gathered, we argued that in terms of the definition, how we think of it as intersectional organizing, that it's a process, a continual process for building an ever-inclusive social justice movement that solicits the voices and participation of marginalized identities and also acknowledges and addresses their amplified oppression in the pursuit of equality and equity. Very simple. Mm. So that's a handful. It's a long, and we discussed this a lot, essentially, of how we would, how we thought about it based on the data. But essentially, key is that we see it as a process. So it's continuous rather than an outcome or a finite set of demographic markers or policy proposals. So meaning that it can essentially never end and it can never reach a perfect state. And that's some of the that's very challenging, of course. And so the goal is to maximize the inclusion of underrepresented voices, so giving them a voice and also addressing their heightened injury. And so from that definition then, if we look at the Women's March, we see two critical components into how they were able to build kind of or think about themselves as an intersectional movement. First, and they're essentially, they run together. It's not a first and a second, but it's about setting an intersectional movement culture and being able to radically confront conflict. And these are key components, we argue, of intersectional organizing. And let me go back to Tammy. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to say about our very long and complicated definition. It matches how long and complicated intersectional organizing is in practice. And one of the reasons why we thought that it was very key to call it a process instead of a set of demographic markers, if you do some research, or if you look at the academic research into Women's March, especially the ones that are talking about intersectionality, often what you'll see is them theorists looking at Women's March and going, they are intersectional because they had one black woman, one white woman, one Chicana, one Muslim Palestinian. And that does not make a movement or an organization intersectional. And if you stop the analysis there, and if you stop the work there, if you are a union organizer or another type of organization who's trying to organize, then you will be guilty of tokenism. And we will get into why that's important, and why we think it's tremendously important. I just want to make sure that we're all in the same space there. So we're not looking at, oh, it's diverse. We're looking at, is it also inclusive, which is why we're looking at a process as opposed to certain policies or demographics.
Yeah. Exactly. So now going to the point of establishing an intersectional movement culture. So also when Tammy did the training on the Kenyan Nonviolence Workshop and had conversations there with one of the main trainers, you would also argue that if you think about a movement culture, it's the DNA essentially that is front-loaded into its strategic planning by the core leadership prior to the launch of a first campaign. So now we were thinking about the Women's March and to what extent is there actually an incorporation of these major tenets of critical race theory and intersectionality. And we knew that from the beginning, they had some challenges and needed to put that up front, that issue of being conscious, acknowledging the issues of race discrimination, issues of intersectionality. And so that starts with how it was set up. So again, the Women's March started essentially with two white women after the election of Trump, the night that Trump won. Posted something on Facebook that we should march against this administration, this new administration. Within the span of 24 hours, over 100,000 people has said they would march. And so then you had these two relatively unexperienced white women who had this large group of followers. That was first, but in addition, they also started to call it the Million Women March. And that's essentially a name that was taken from a movement that was in the 90s in Philadelphia, set up and originated by black women. So that was already an issue of appropriation right there. And they also acknowledged immediately themselves kind of the white dominance and the absence or exclusion of non-privileged identities. So Bob Bland would then say, they were asking her, who's leading us and where are the people of color? Where are the Muslims? And they were going through the lists of people that were saying that wanted to march in unity and saying, yeah, but where are they in leadership? So there was only white leadership. And at that point, people said, like, look, you're all white, like all of you. And we were like, oh, shit, yeah, you're right. And so it was the first kind of acknowledgement of these white women thinking, we can't lead a movement like that. And if we really want to talk for all women or talk with all women, we got to be, we have to actually have women of color lead and also center essentially their identities. Yeah.
One point of clarification, which is that the white women didn't sort of figure it out on their own. This was a really difficult conversation that happened in terms of helping those two white women understand why it was important to bring people of color and trans people and people from the disability community on board to key positions. That was an educational process, and we'll get to that component that we think Women's March does well, which is to confront when you've made a mistake and when you've overlooked a community. So, you know, I love Bob and Teresa are very, very nice and kind white ladies, but it wasn't, in fact, a process to get them to be aware of sort of erasing other people who were not included originally.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a very good point. And you can already tell how easy it is for like a white person as myself to already not acknowledge that this actually doesn't come by itself, but that for the other, you know, white women, but that there was a whole process and that they needed to be made aware that this isn't how it's gonna work. And so I'm just saying, even now I forget to account for the agency essentially of people of color in that sense. Yes, yeah. Did you wanna? Wait, you're on speaker.
We had methodologically an intersectional research team so that we could talk through these things. And you can imagine that if we did write the story and say, oh, these white women were super nice and they knew all the time that there was an issue, that is an erasure of one narrative of what actually happened in that process. So it was really important for Maite and I to sort of be able to think through this theoretically from different lenses.
Exactly. And also, we have some other quotes, for example, from, I think it was also Bob Land or was it Cassidy, one of the two white people, saying also about how when they were asked to describe themselves, they wouldn't say, like, I'm a white woman. They would say, I'm a fashion designer, I'm this and that. And because being part of this, they were made, they needed to kind of much more acknowledge their white privilege, essentially. And that was also new for some of them. So essentially, it's establishing that intersectional movement culture, this kind of the DNA, and that started very early on by communities of color pointing out again that white dominance and how we need to how it couldn't work a movement like that. And then also very critical was this adoption of the March, the 2017 March Unity Principles. And Tammy, again, was part of some of these conversations and can tell more about how difficult these have been. But essentially, in terms of the unity principles, we also link it back again to kind of the work that unions do. As we'll say later, it isn't because it's a women's march that it has nothing to do with industrial relations or employment and work, because a lot of what they talk about is directly about work, about employment, and for example, saying, and I highlighted the one, we stand in full solidarity with the sex workers' rights movement, but here you see a lot of them, and I'll talk a little bit more in detail now about some of these. But so these unity principles was really as with a couple of quotes, I want to try to make clear what that was and how hard it was. So first, as Linda Sarsour, one of the main leaders, would say, the unity principles reflect the participation of women of color, We were very clear that racial justice, maternal justice, issues of immigration, reproductive freedom, civil liberties, voting rights, we made sure issues impacting all women, but in particular women of color, were central to our unity principles. And I don't know if that would have happened without women of color participating, especially at the highest levels of leadership. So essentially, again, showing that you need people of color in leadership and leadership, and also to have a voice. So it's not just about token diversity, as Tammy mentioned earlier. And then as Carmen Perez mentioned, the principles needed to be rooted in a world we wanted to create for women in our communities. Women are not monolith, and so we needed to bring our full selves. Meaning, I am Chicana from immigrant parents with family members who are incarcerated. We knew indigenous women had to be involved because their voices have been consistently erased from historical and political narrative. So you can, on the one hand, already see kind of the challenges that that might bring if you're starting to think about all these type of intersections, because it's never ending. And so then there was also critique. There was critique from white women who would say, it seems so scattered and unfocused, and people would ask, why are there so many issues? And they would ask this because they wanted essentially to feel easy. But people would argue the unity principles reflect all women and all their intersecting identities, which historically feminism has left out. And we know that also from gender studies and feminist studies, that historically, at least in the U.S., this was essentially white feminism, really excluding any type of black, queer women from the movement. And so this is a first attempt, essentially, to come up with these principles in a very inclusive way. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to add from a theoretical perspective for us, when we start looking at unions and intersectionality, what's key, I think, in these examples of from Linda and Carmen, is that you get to see sort of the problem with having a melting pot approach by the dominant groups, right? So while the white women who were involved really were like, you know, let's just all fight for feminism and this super melting pot version of feminism, you can see that for organizers of color, they didn't look at the Trump election from a melting pot perspective, right? Both of these women separately and then also jointly were like, yeah, it's really important not to treat us all as one group of women, but actually there are some other things that we're marching for. And so when we start thinking about unions, we need to challenge whether or not our approach to solidarity building mirrors some things that that were happening at the beginning of Women's March that they actively and aggressively confronted.
Yeah. And so then, to move on just a little bit in terms of time, so these unity principles, as I said, was really about, and as Tammy said, really about intentionally centering the most marginalized identities, and had also a lot of links with, again, work and labor. So again, this is how it focused, and I'm not going to go over this, but this is just some slides that that show kind of also the focus actually on workers' rights. So then we're at some of these challenges, and that will get us to the next session essentially. But you can already, again, imagine how it's very difficult to come up with these unity principles, and they can seem scattered and unfocused, but on the other hand, it's the first kind of platform that is trying to be so inclusive and give voices to underrepresented groups. But there were challenges, and so there were different ones around sex worker inclusion, pro-life inclusion, trans inclusion, disability inclusion, anti-Semitism charges. So this didn't go very, like, always very smoothly and very easy. There were challenges, but then it's a way of how you deal with it and how you confront it that is critical also for this movement. And just to give one example, from the sex worker inclusion, so there was at the point there were discussions whether to actually, so you saw in the beginning I had the sentence in there that was part of the unity principles, we stand in full solidarity with sex workers. before, there was actually a discussion within the group whether actually that was, in terms of thinking about sex work, some found it too patriarchal almost to include or to be considered feminist. And so therefore the language was altered and weakened. And so then there was a backlash from the sex workers and others that they were offended by it. And so this is, for example, Janet Mock, one of the leaders and a transgender activist. She would say, then afterwards it came back in, and it came back in stronger, but people were very upset by it. And so she would argue, it's not a statement that is controversial to me. So adding these, saying that sex workers need to be, we're in full solidarity with sex workers. It's not a statement that is controversial to me, because as a trans woman of color who grew up in low-income communities and who advocates, resists, dreams, and rights along these communities, I know that underground communities are essential parts of the lived realities of women and folk. I know sex work to be work. It's not something I need to tiptoe around. It's not a radical statement. It's a fact. I cannot speak to the internal conflicts at the Women's March that have led to the erasure of the line I wrote for a collective vision, but I have been assured that the line will remain in our document. The conflicts that may have led to its temporary editing will not leave until we as feminists respect the rights of every woman and person to do what they want with their body and their lives. There are no throwaway people, and I hope every sex worker who has felt ashamed by this momentary erasure shows up to their local march and holds the collective accountable to our diverse, complicated realities. So this shows some of these challenges that then happen also within the organization and how they try to deal with it. And yeah.
Well, I just wanted to sort of maybe give the audience the backstory, what happened, which is that Gloria Steinem was brought on to be an honorary chair of the Women's March on Washington. And while the Unity Principles were being drafted by the national organizers, Gloria Steinem's team wanted to soften the sex work language. If you know a lot about U.S. white feminism, in the second wave, sex work was, you know, deemed too patriarchal to be feminist. And so Gloria is from that era of feminism. And so the younger people who were part of the movement and the trans community, who for the first time is part of a big mainstream movement like this, were triggered by what they felt as an erasure of sex work as work. And it was an intense internal battle within Women's March to get that language back in and to make reparations in a way with the trans community about what this march was going to be about. So,
yeah, thanks for that, Tammy.
Can I ask about age? I'm just wondering about the different generations. Like, you mentioned Gloria Steinem, and I was wondering about one of the intersections being age. Youth in particular, because you just mentioned younger people.
Yeah, and Tammy, so the question here is, can we mention something about age and that intergenerational, because I know you've also, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it factors in a number of levels, in a number of ways into the strategic organizing and what we are calling intersectional organizing. A lot of these questions of erasure of different identities are tied to the social construction of race and gender, which obviously is tied to what society thought about it at the time that they decided that they would call a woman, or what is black. And those notions change over time, right? And so just like in the civil rights movement, there is a big split in the African-American culture between, the people who marched with Dr. King and their approach to nonviolence, and the younger folks who want to organize in a way that, you know, has nonviolence as a tactic, but not the only thing. So on the topic of feminism, there was a fierce generation gap between second wave and this wave of feminism. You know, you would hear a lot from young people talking to the older generation, if your feminism isn't intersectional, it's trash. This is something that was said a lot by a lot of different groups, subgroups within the younger generation who was organizing. And what that means is you cannot organize on a melting pot type of this is what our definition of womanhood is. If you do that, then you are not intersectional and you're erasing whole groups of women. And we have another example later that I hope we can get to if we're running out of time about the pussy hats that the older white generation of women brought into the movement and the backlash internally against the pussy hats and the Hillary Democrats, as they sort of got labeled within the movement. But hopefully that's enough right now, but we can follow up in more detail if you want to hear about that.
Okay, yes, thank you.
Since you mentioned about timing, there's still about 25 minutes left. At first, I thought, okay, they'll just do the whole thing and then the questions. But if you're comfortable with them continuing on this like rich and interesting story, but you can interject any time with questions, does that work? Does anyone want to ask?
There'll be no question period?
I don't know what I'm saying. I was sort of suggesting like it could carry on for a little bit longer, and maybe at 10 minutes there could be a pure question answer. Is that? Yeah, so girl, maybe if you grow, okay, are you guys able to wrap up in about 10 minutes so that there's a,
yeah,
that we have about 15 for question answer?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so let's go to so some of the challenges, and then also this one brings again some of these challenges as kind of the different starting points for organizing, and that gets again at kind of that white feminism versus then thinking about feminism of color, queer feminism. So essentially, these are some of the speeches, the statements that the key leaders made at the Women's March, at the march itself. And you can clearly see kind of the different starting points. So Bob, so the person on the left, Bob Blanz, is the white woman who kind of started the Facebook group. She's talking about, this is just the beginning of a movement. We are co-creating together with women at the center of it. She says, I've never done anything like this, so you can do this too. Very different starting point, of course, from the other three women of color who were key leaders in their communities, key organizers that talk about, for example, Tamika talks about, to those of you who for the first time felt the pain that my people have felt since they were brought here with chains shackled on our legs. So talking about, this is not the first time this has happened to us. Others then mentioned, for example, Linda Sarsour mentioned how we need to follow women of color. We need the battery.
Okay.
It's gonna go out.
Carry on.
How we need to follow women of color, and also talking about to know that those closest to the problem are also those closest to solution. So we need to trust them, stand with them in your actions. So the second element of that intersectional organizing is then this practicing, this radical confrontation. Because again, for it, as Tammy also mentioned, for it to be successful, you don't only have to have, for example, women of color, and say we have women of color, but you also need this process of being able to confront the challenges, to build solidarity that really centers, raises, and prioritizes the most vulnerable identities. So we define that radical confrontation as the application of a CRTI lens, so critical race theory intersectionality lens, to understand sources of conflict between groups and to intentionally confront the divisions between privileged and unprivileged identities. So there's a couple of key points within the Women's March. So first, they talk about how conflict is neutral, meaning that the focus is not on how to defeat your opponent, but it's about how you will respond in a certain way to conflict so that your opponent can be transformed into an ally. And they build on the principles from Dr. King and from Kingian nonviolence and practice essentially those principles. And so they think about it in terms of a spectrum of allies in which you will try to move your opponents from, say, passive opponents to neutral to passive ally to active ally. So it's a process that you go through. And you don't just focus on active allies, active opponents, but it's more thinking about how you move your opponents from the right to more to the left.
And it's by confronting, as we will say then later, it's about, there's different techniques and different ways that they do that, where there's processes set up. And this Kingian non-violence was an ideology that brought, that was brought by, via Carmen Perez, one of the key leaders, to the movement. Okay, just in terms of time, and Tammy, feel free if you want to intersect. So some of the examples of how do you confront, what are some of these challenges? One is they talk about confronting white womanhood and specifically or actively silencing dissent. That means that actively silencing dissent means that you will teach privileged identities to sit in their feelings while underrepresented groups are giving a voice. So they had, for example, this workshop in Detroit called Confronting White Womanhood. And that means that when people of color speak up and they say something, we as white women shouldn't interfere and say, oh, I just never had that, or oh, I was like this, oh, I had this boyfriend, things like that. We need to just sit with it and listen and trying to figure it out. And that's very tough, they argue. And that is about like confronting white womanhood. That was one example. The other example of confronting, kind of radically confronting, practicing this radical confrontation is, as Tammy mentioned before, the example of the pussy hats. So during the Women's March, there were these pink hats that a lot of the women were wearing, partly an initiative by white women, white Hillary Clinton women voters. But essentially then there was backlash, because there was then also a whole workshop about it, because that does not work for all the women. And so the workshop was about how not all pussies are pink and not all women have pussies. And so to address, this is again radically essentially confronting these things that seem very normal for a lot of people, but then at the same time you don't include, again, you just exclude automatically voices and underrepresented groups without even thinking about it. Okay, so to conclude, we have some implications in terms of theory, especially industrial relations theory, since we're both in that field, but then also implications, of course, for the labor movement. So first, we argue that critical race theory and intersectionality is crucial in terms of it's crucial that we put, that we draw upon that within our industrial relations research, and that's a way of actually confronting the dominance of white and other privileged narratives. As I said earlier, within the highest quality journals, there's absolutely no mention of any of these theories. And as Matsuda also argued, it's about scholarship and coalition. So she argues, she says, for example, it's no accident that women of color, grounded as they are in both feminist and anti-racist struggle, are doing the most exciting theoretical work on race-gender intersections. It's no accident that gay and lesbian scholars are advancing social construction theory and the analysis of sexuality and subordination. In raising this, I do not mean that we cannot speak of subordination secondhand, but rather I wish to encourage us to do this and to suggest that we do this most intelligently in coalition, listening with special care to those who are actively involved in knowing and ending the systems of domination that touch their lives. So also from a theoretical perspective, if we talk about any issue, we argue, Tamia and I argue, if we talk about any phenomena in terms of work and employment, we need to have in our mind and need to take on a CRT analysis. It's not an option in that sense. And if we don't, then we ignore essentially important counter-narratives, and that then results in kind of a less than full understanding of the phenomena or the obstacles faced by unions and how they organize groups. There's a lot of work that shows that unions weren't able to organize these workers. But sometimes in these works, there's no mention of race, gender, and if it is, it's very descriptive, but not at the, any, doesn't seem to be any of the, acknowledged as one of the root causes of why it might have not worked. In addition, from a theory perspective, taking on the CRTI lens also expands our universe of cases. A case in point, when we first suggested or had this draft paper on the Women's March, And for IR journals, a lot of the kind of gatekeepers, male white gatekeepers, came back to us and said, it's very interesting, but why is that relevant for industrial relations? So that's because they see it so, they don't see the intersections essentially between economistic and social identities, and how issues that the Women's March works on has crucial critical implications for work, for employment, and so on, and so how you can't keep these apart as well. Sorry, Tammy, did you have your hand up?
Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about that discussion we had with the editors of our top journal about why the Women's March case was an industrial relations case study relevant to industrial relations. And just that question in itself is super white. And what I mean by that is, if you say that, if you say, I can't see the link between the biggest social movement of the day and labor struggles, then that means you've erased every single African-American social movement in the United States. I mean, Dr. King was assassinated at a Memphis sanitation strike during the Poor People's Campaign. So for Black people and for Black scholars like myself, those are inherently related. That's the Black experience, that protest movements are issues of labor justice and racial justice, and those things are inherently intersectional. And so that's what we're trying to challenge industrial relations research to do, which is to say, let's break out of always looking at this dominant sort of hegemonic approach to what is a labor question, and consider what we can learn from movements and from the experiences and narratives of people who aren't always showing up in our literature and in our research. And maybe there are things that we should be listening to.
Exactly. And also, for example, even when we went back then to our our syllabi, for example, on industrial relations theory, there were absolutely no people of color that were even referenced in the stuff that we read, for example. Ooh, it's out.
Tammy? So the laptop usually lasts...